Let's look together at Isaiah chapter 40. We're going to finish, by God's grace, this evening what we did not finish on the Lord's Day in Isaiah chapter 40. We made our way to verse 25, and let's pick up the reading there again. We'll just work our way through these verses as we go. We have a question raised here in verse 25. And as we noted Sunday afternoon, one way of approaching this passage is to look at the questions and the responses to the questions. This question is in verse 25, "To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal? Saith the Holy One." This question is almost verbatim the question also in verse 18. "To whom then will ye liken me, or what likeness will ye," "to whom then will ye liken God, or what likeness will ye compare unto him?" And here it's the Lord himself speaking in first person. And you notice he calls himself the Holy One here in verse 25. The one who is set apart from all others. The one who is holy. The very existence of all others is what it is because of him and his will and his purpose and his power. Now, since Isaiah repeats this question, then it's good for us to repeat it and to consider it briefly once again. Is there anything that compares to God? No, nothing compares to God. There's no point of reference that we can have with God. He is who he is. Nothing else is like him. There's no baseline from which to measure him. And we saw that worked out as far as things on earth are concerned in verses 19 and following. As far as any idol or graven image is concerned. It is interesting to remember what we saw just a couple of chapters back, how that King Sennacherib viewed Jehovah as simply one among many gods. And Sennacherib says and boasts, "I have all these other gods under my belt. I have them as notches in my gun or in the handle of my sword, perhaps. And the God of the Jews, Jehovah, will just be another notch for me." Sennacherib made this great mistake of thinking that God was just one among many. Not so. There's none like him. There's none who is equal to him. He is above all. He is the Holy One. But now, in response to this question, we are pointed not to earth, not to man and his idols. We're pointed to the heavens. "Lift up your eyes on high, and behold who hath created these things, that bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power. Not one faileth." The point here seems to be that not only is there nothing on earth that is like God, there's nothing in the celestial realm that is like God. The host mentioned here, or the things that are brought out, yes, the host by number, is evidently a reference to the stars, as is the case in a very similar statement in Psalm 147 and verse 4. There's nothing in earth or heaven comparable to God. All that is in heaven, the stars, the universe, our solar system, everything that we can see, everything that we can magnify and have some knowledge of, is simply God's handiwork. It is the work of His hands. It's easy. It's nothing for Him. As we saw back in verse 12, He stretched out the heavens. It's like spreading out a tent in verse 22. No one then does what God does. No one is like unto Him. It speaks of His numbering and naming of the stars. He calleth them all by names by the greatness of His might, for that He is strong in power. Not one faileth. He sustains them. And some of these constellations that we look at on a starry night are the same ones that Job and his friends were looking at way back in those days. They continue, at least as long as God sees fit for them to continue. Now, we cannot number the stars. I just did a little research on this, and the best guess that man is able to give, it seems, is that there are maybe about 1 billion trillion stars. That's a 1 with 21 zeros behind it. Now, that's just a guess. That's just a guess. They really don't know. No man knows. God knows. Not only does He know the number, because He made them all, but it says that He calls them by names. And I'm sure that I don't understand all the significance of that. Certainly that the power to name a thing is an authority over that thing. As Adam named the animals and so on, and God named Adam, God names the stars. It shows His authority over them and His being the creator of them. Can you imagine if men tried to name the 1 billion trillion stars? How many lifetimes would it take? And then how would you know if you had not used a name previously used, and you're going to have to name this one Junior or the third or something? You'd run out of names. It's inconceivable. But it says that God has names for them all. What an amazing thing. Who can compare to God in that? We're not even close. Now, that brings us to the last question of the chapter here. That begins in, or the series of questions, begins in verse 27 and goes through most of verse 28. The questions are these. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? And at least in my translation, that's where the question mark, the last question mark appears. And the rest of it is considered to be a statement. All these previous questions that we've seen, beginning from verse 12, seem to be more rhetorical. This one may be more of an investigative question. For those people in Israel or Judah who thought perhaps that God had forgotten them, especially the generations that would be held in Babylonian captivity. They would be wondering, where is God? Why doesn't He deliver us? What about the covenant made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David? Why are we here? You know, sometimes we tend to think that our problem is too great for God. Now, that's a very bad thought to entertain. It's a grave mistake. And what we've seen here in Isaiah 40 certainly shows us that there's no problem too great for God. God is greater than all of our problems put together. On the other hand, we may have such a view of the immensity and greatness of God as set forth in this chapter that we may think that our problems are too small for God. That He doesn't have time to be concerned with little you and me and our needs. And I tend to think that that's what we're to learn from these questions in verse 27. My way is hid from the Lord. God doesn't see. He doesn't care. He's not concerned. He's running the universe. My judgment is passed over from my God. Isaiah, if what you've said thus far is so, that God is so great and He governs the whole universe, then how could He possibly focus on little me? Just one little, like a piece of sand on the seashore. God isn't going to render justice in my case. My judgment is passed over from my God. Not judgment in a punitive sense, but judgment in an exonerating sense, in a helping sense. God isn't going to hear my case and render judgment for me. And that, of course, is in its own way, just as much an error as to say that my problem is too great for God. Let us not make either mistake in either direction. It's interesting that in the first part of verse 27, Israel, Judah, let's use that term here, Judah is referred to as Jacob. And then after that, as Israel. Jacob, of course, was the name of weakness for that Old Testament character. His name was changed to Israel by God. When God refers to Judah then, or the nation here, as Jacob, He's underscoring their own sense of weakness. And the appearance of weakness and the feeling of weakness that they had from time to time in their national life and that they would have especially in the captivity in Babylon. And God is concerned about this little, weak kingdom and this little, impoverished, enslaved nation. He has not forgotten them. And He doesn't forget any of His people. He doesn't forget you, child of God. He is concerned. Remember, the God who sustains, who creates and sustains the billion, trillion stars is the same God who so loved the world. This little world, this little planet, a speck in the universe, that He gave His beloved and only begotten Son for whoever would believe in Him. What great condescension. What a long reach downward. God's arm is longer than we can measure to reach as far down as we are in saving mercy and grace. Why should we say, my way is hid from the Lord? My judgment is passed over from my God. Verse 28 sounds quite similar to the question of verse 21. Hast thou not known? Only here it's put in the singular for each one of us to consider personally. Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? Are you ignorant? Haven't you heard? Don't you know that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, Creator of all things, fainteth not, neither is weary. He's not too tired to consider your case. He's not too occupied to consider your need. He's not worn out. He's not on vacation. God is never tired, never weary like we are. And He knows everything. We get that in the last part of the verse. There's no searching of His understanding. He knows everything. He knows where Israel is. He knows where each one of His blood-bought children are. His understanding, His knowledge is not limited. Again, that 147th Psalm says, His understanding is infinite. No searching of His understanding. His knowledge is beyond comprehension. We measure intelligence quotient. There's no measuring scale for God. What are you going to measure Him by? He is the standard. And there's no searching of His understanding. But this great, mighty, infinite, all-knowing, all-sustaining God concerns Himself with faint, little, weak people like you and me. This is why this chapter is a comfort to God's people. It is not that we are just blown away by His power. It's that His power is focused individually upon you, child of God. He knows you, weak one. He giveth, verse 29, power to the faint, and to them that have no might, He increaseth strength. There is no weakness on God's part. Quite the contrary. He is the one who gives strength. He is the source of strength. He's the one who gives strength. We don't have to worry about Him running out. There's no limit to His knowledge or to His strength. The weakness is in us, not in Him. And without His supply of strength, what happens to us? Verse 30 tells us, even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. The ones who we would assume to be the strong ones, young people, young men, they're the ones that without God's strength prove to be faint, weary, weak, and faltering. Matthew Henry comments this way, those who trust to their own sufficiency are so confident of it that they neither exert themselves to the utmost nor seek unto God for His grace, are the youth and young men who are strong but are apt to think themselves stronger than they are. And they shall faint and be weary, yea, they shall utterly fail in their services, in their conflicts, and under their burdens. They shall soon be made to see the folly of trusting to themselves. Woe be unto us if God does not give us strength, and if God does not sustain us. We think we're strong, but we deceive ourselves. And we will discover one way or another how weak we really are. But here's the glorious contrast in verse 31. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. We mentioned Sunday there are several passages in the Psalms that are closely parallel to many of these things. Here is another one in this verse about the eagle's wings. Psalm 103 says that God satisfieth thy mouth with good things so that thy youth is renewed like the eagle's. Well, as long as we trust in ourselves and think that we are strong, God will see to it that we prove to be weak. When we recognize our weakness, confess our need of His strength, in other words, wait upon the Lord, then what happens? He gives strength. He imparts strength. He causes our strength to be renewed. And I'm not altogether sure what to make of the illustration here of flying and then running and then walking. We might have expected it to be in the opposite order, to say that with God's strength, we will walk and run and soar right into heaven. That would make for a wonderful sermon outline, wouldn't it? But one writer observed that the order in which these things are presented may be in the order, or maybe the order of a progress of difficulty. The easiest thing to do is to fly. That is, when there's the least resistance. But then, when the going gets more difficult and we're not soaring through the air, our feet are on the earth and we have to run. And then the pathway gets even more difficult. Too difficult to run. And we have to walk. And God, in each instance, continues to give His people strength. If not to fly, then to run. If not to run, then to walk. To somehow, by His enabling, to keep plodding on. To keep putting one foot in front of the other as we walk with the Lord through this difficult life. We may not know how we can take one more step. And in our own strength, we cannot. But with God's enabling strength, we can. And we do. God is our refuge and strength. It is Him that we wait upon. And you may recall, not too long ago in Psalm 130, we looked at this word wait. It's the same word here in verse 31. That waiting is not a passive, unconscious experience. It is a diligent, active effort. Sinclair Ferguson puts it this way: waiting on God, being silent before Him, may involve a protracted battle with the world, the flesh, and the devil. That's what waiting on God looks like. It's the Christian warfare. It's looking to Him, continually trusting in Him, and looking to Him for strength. And so this is the comfort to God's people, that He is our Creator, Sustainer, Redeemer, our Covenant God, our Merciful Heavenly Father, the One who takes a personal interest in us, who will not leave us nor forsake us, who keeps giving us strength. And none who wait upon Him wait in vain. I wasn't going to read this Sunday, but I will read it this evening, since we have plenty of time. Just a paragraph from a commentary I've enjoyed using here on Isaiah by Derek Thomas. He says, and this is a lovely application to us. It may appear as though there is no hope. This is a dangerous time. There is a temptation to give up. Maybe you are at this point right now. The beginning of your Christian life was exciting. Everything seemed to go well for you. Blessing abounded. But lately it seems as though you have been punished. At first you may have thought to yourself, "Well, I deserved it." But as the days and weeks passed, the problems got worse and worse. Now it seems you are caught up in the middle of something and you don't understand what is happening. You find your resolve is weakening. You know exactly what the writer to the Hebrews meant when he talked about feeble arms and weak knees. You are in the middle of a race and up against what long-distance runners refer to as the wall. That is, the point in the middle of the race where every cell in your body tells you to stop. This is the worst moment of all, when you have to resolve to keep going. That's what the Scriptures encourage us to do. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. The finishing tape is just ahead. Lift your eyes up. Or verse 26, lift up your eyes on high, and behold who hath created these things. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Do it now, and you will fly high above your troubles like a mighty eagle. He concludes this chapter with these words: waiting on God, His ways, His thoughts, His timing. This is the key to spiritual growth and maturity. Well, whatever else we may or may not do, let us make sure that we wait upon the Lord. And I agree with Mr. Thomas, that is the key to spiritual growth and maturity. And God is always growing us and maturing us over and over, more and more, all throughout our Christian experience. Let us wait upon Him, look to Him for strength, be actively trusting in Him, in His Word, in meditation, in prayer, looking to Him, waiting upon Him. We never wait on Him in vain. He always comes when we need Him most. And He comes with sustaining grace for the tasks at hand. I will close with a word of wisdom that was given to me at my ordination. A dear brother who's with the Lord now, Brother Dick Gilley, laid his hands upon my head, and his word that he said has stuck with me all these years. He said, "Daniel, the providence of God will never lead you where the grace of God will not sustain you." Now, I'm sure that was not original with him, and I've heard that elsewhere, but it was hearing it then from him that impressed that in my memory for life. The providence of God will not lead you where the grace of God will not sustain you. And you know, he was right. At least thus far, by God's grace. And let us all then go on with confidence in the Lord, looking to Him for grace to sustain us, waiting upon Him for the renewing of our strength. We have reasons to pray abounding here among us in various circumstances and needs at this time. Let us continually wait upon the Lord and call unto Him.